All right, we're in .NET World, Building 42, BCL land. Who are you?
Hi, I'm Lita Anderson. I'm a PM on the BCL team, or program manager. And I work on things like globalization and managed contracts and some of the base classes like datetime or integer.
All right, that's her, datetime. All right.
Yeah. Hi, my name's Brian Grunkemeyer. I'm the senior console.writeline developer.
Wow.
Been working here for a little while.
Yes.
It's been a lot of fun.
You've been on C9 before. Nice to see you again.
Yeah. Good to see you.
Hi, I'm Matt Ellis. I'm a developer as well. I'm not a senior developer on anything, but I own the diagnostics namespace as well as isolated storage.
Excellent.
Hi, I'm Josh Free. I'm also a developer on the BCL team. I own many of the things in the system namespace.
All right.
I'm Justin Van Patten. I'm a PM on the BCL team. I do a little bit of everything. My focus is mainly on I/O, regex, and API design.
Nice.
I'm Kim Hamilton. I'm a developer on the BCL team, and I own collections, resources, I/O.
Excellent.
Hi, I'm Matt Gregg. I'm a tester on the BCL team, and I test the registry and collections and numerics.
All right. Hi.
Hi, I'm Katie King. I'm a tester on the BCL team. I test I/O and daytime, time zone, and some other stuff.
And you've been on Channel 9 before?
Yes.
Yeah, see, my memory is not completely gone. So we're at BCL 4.0, right? .NET 4.0. What are some of the core changes that you want to talk about today? You can focus on your own spaces, or let's just gonna start with Brian because he's a familiar face.
Sure. So we've done a huge number of little pieces to help people out. A lot of these have been around reducing some of the redundancy out there that people have been running into. We have a lot of teams that want to build various parts of the framework on top of what we're doing. A good example might be a language like F# needs some new types. But if they add those new types just to their own library, then it's only going to be useful to the F# users. It's not going to be useful to a Visual Basic or the people writing managed COBOL implementations or C# or anything like that. So instead, we're looking for the right pieces to bring into the BCL. And so that's one of the core things we've been going after here.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So I think, like, in this release, we've really tried to focus on becoming more language agnostic, where we have to realize that C# and VB aren't our only customers, especially now with F# coming into the framework. We need to be reactive to their requests, and with the new DLR, like IronRuby and IronPython, there are some new features that we did in 4.0 to really enable some scenarios that were important for them, but that VB and C# developers probably didn't place as high a priority on.
Mm-hmm. One of the other areas I should weigh in on is responding to customer feedback.
Yes.
So we also got to address a few customer pain points around performance and just commonly requested features.
So, I mean, that's a great starting point for a little bit of a conversation, right? I mean, we're at 4.0 now, or we haven't released it yet, but we're going to. You know, what have you learned? And, you know, one of the things that .NET got immediately off the bat thrashed for was performance, right? People always ragged on performance. But the great Rico Mariani took care of that a little bit with his incredible blog posts. But there still is this, it still exists today, that you're going to run into performance issues if you want to use managed code, if you want to use garbage collected runtime, you're going to run into problems. Is that, I mean, can we talk about improvements there?
Yeah, so we can talk a little bit about that. There's kind of two aspects to that. There's sort of what we do in the actual runtime, CLR improvements, and that would be improvements like the JIT, things like that.
Yeah.
There's also things that we do on kind of our team, which is more of the library aspect of it. So,
fair enough.
For instance, like String Builder. We did some work in String Builder to improve performance. Instead of kind of allocating big arrays every time you kind of push over the bounds, now we're kind of doing more of a chunking approach. So there's more improvements, benefits in 4.0 there. There's also new APIs that we added as well. So one of them was around file system enumeration improvements. So in the past, we've had APIs. So if you want to get, like, the list of files in a directory, for example, we have APIs that return an array. And the problem with that is if it's a directory that contains lots of files, you're going to wait for this huge array to allocate and then basically get this array after the entire enumeration has taken place and it's already been allocated. And if you're going over a network, that's even more kind of painful because you have to kind of, you have all the issues where you're going over the network to kind of get all this information. So what we've done in 4.0 is actually add new APIs that return IEnumerable instead of arrays. So that way you can basically get the files on demand as they're immediately returned from the OS, and you don't have to wait for this huge array to allocate.
Very cool. Good. So yeah, I mean, again, I should stress, we're starting, this is actually the beginning of a string of conversations we're going to have, digging in eventually into the lowest parts of the CLR. So we're starting at the base class library and moving down. So I'll now start asking BCL questions instead of CLR ones, so forgive me about that.
No, it's okay, because we're sort of, we are the public face of the CLR in
certainly.
A sense. So.
I mean, you're what we programmed.
Right.
Perfect.
Exactly.
So let's talk about what else is going on in 4.0. I mean, what's new at the library level? I mean, certainly the library is getting larger, yes?
So okay. One of the cool new things that we've added in .NET Framework, Framework 4.0 is the big integer type. So there's a new system.numeric.bigInteger. This is an important type for functional languages that want to program with just an integral type and not be... not focus so much on fixed type integers.
This is dynamic languages as well.
Right. So we partnered with a lot of experts in the company to come up with a very fast solution. Mm-hmm. So this is something we're kind of proud of in 4.0.
Excellent. Now regarding daytime, we're not you've ensured we're not going to have any problems with what we experienced with the Zune on. When was that? Like
December?
Yeah. Right? You got all that taken care of down in the framework?
If you're going to use our date time offset class that takes the time zones into account, then yeah, you should be fine with that.
Very cool.
Yes.
So, I mean, on a serious note, though, I mean, the CLR, I mean, the base class library continues to grow and grow, but are you guys, like, removing things? You're finding people aren't using things? I mean, it's a really large, incredibly functional set of you know, programmability. I mean, over the years, have you found that, well, this really wasn't a very good idea, why should we...
Yeah, Brian can probably mention a little bit about this. He's been thinking about this.
Good.
So we realize that sometimes we have redundant technology that we ship. Sometimes it's because we had two different groups working on the same thing, essentially, at different times, and they simply couldn't resolve things before they ship. But often it's because we put something together and... it was good at the time, but then the world changed, so it no longer applied. An interesting example is if you look back at what happened in C++, all of their strings use single-byte characters. That was a perfectly fine decision for 1985, but if you start looking at anything now in the world, it looks embarrassingly out of date. So there are technology needs to evolve over time, and we must have a way to remove things that we are adding to the framework. So... we're looking at ways to stage that in a safe way so that we do not cause horrendous problems for our customers. Mm. You start getting into issues about, you know, exactly which versions of the CLR are deployed on the machine, mm-hmm. and can you use, say, the 4.0 and the 3.5 CLR in a side-by-side manner? And that works if you have both installed on the machine, but simply setting up our bits on the machine is a big obstacle for people. Mm-hmm. So all of this feeds into where we are going with the obsolete attribute. We're looking at expanding this into several different categories, such as, you know, legacy APIs where you can continue to use them, but they're not what we want you to use anymore. So we'll try to hide those a little bit. We also want to frankly acknowledge when we have an API that's just flat out broken. Thread.suspend is an excellent example of a broken API where it's a great way to introduce deadlocks with all the other threads in your process and involving complicated stuff with the garbage collector. People simply shouldn't call that API, and we want to go call that out as a separate thing so people understand, look, this is broken. It's not something that... we just don't want you to use in a polite way, but no, we want to be very aggressive about that. So, additionally, we're looking for perhaps taking entire functional areas, such as perhaps just a hypothetical example, the XML DOM. we might say, look, we've got, you know, three or four different technologies for reading XML. The XML DOM is a very slow way to do that. We want to instead move it out into its own assembly. We'll ship it in one version where it's sort of hidden, and you don't pick it up unless you explicitly add references to it, mm-hmm. but it'll still be available for people. Then, eventually, in some future version, we'll simply stop shipping it. So that's a core part of our challenge, is to evolve the framework over time. And it's a big area of investment for us.
So from my point of view, one other thing that's interesting is that a lot of the components I own in the diagnostics namespace, like event log and performance counter, are built on top of Win32 technologies, which is sort of different from other areas of BCL, like Blisk, that sort of has no Win32 counterpart. It's definitely like a platform agnostic concept. And Windows is always evolving their sort of programming interfaces as well. So one thing that we've seen when Vista came out is Windows has created sort of new ways of doing performance counters, new ways of doing event logging, and they've created sort of V2 libraries for all of this stuff. And so an interesting challenge that we're going to face is as people want to start consuming those APIs because they're more rich than their current ones, we're going to end up in this interesting world where we have these sort of legacy APIs that are for down-level platforms before Vista, and then we have something that we want to start getting our customers to move to in the future. Another interesting thing Brian brought up about factoring, and you can see probably a pretty good example of it in 4.0, is the numerics type that Josh was talking about, big integer, and also a new type that we're adding, which is complex, are both in the system's numerics namespace, but they ship in a new assembly that we're adding, which is system numerics DLL.
Excellent.
So this is sort of, in the past, we've sort of had the two main BCL assemblies were MS Core Lib and System DLL, and we're sort of moving now to a world where we're going to have more assemblies that are focused on specific problems instead of just a hodgepodge of types in one or two major assemblies.
Marvelous. I mean, that's one of the things I think early on, too, was the notion of, you know, a non-modular giant thing that you had to download before you could start writing code. And I know, talking to Scott Guthrie, that there's been thinking and actually work been done to start pulling dependencies apart, so you can maybe someday have an on-demand runtime.
Yeah, certainly it's something we're interested in. Not anytime soon, I don't think. So we're sort of thinking
we should stay at this iteration.
Right.
But there was definitely work done in 3.5 around the client profile to get us closer to having a smaller redist size for client applications.
That's true, and Silverlight as well. So one of the benefits of having the system.numerics assembly now is that actually if we want to ship that in Silverlight as well, we can ship that assembly as a transparent extension. So people who don't want to use it, they don't have to pay the penalty of the size, downloading the size. If they want to use it, then they're welcome to doing that. So that's one of the things we're looking at.
Cool. So I'm going to go to people now that aren't talking, because this typically happens in Microsoft meetings, right? The PMs and the developers even will talk too much. So what exactly do you test?
Well, I test registry, numerics, and collections.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we did that was had a lot of requests over the time for improving what we allow you to do with the registry over time, because a lot of those have been available on the native side.
Mm-hmm.
But working through the managed, what's available on the managed, you couldn't do things like access, if you're running a 64-bit process, you couldn't access a 32-bit registry hives. They are so just adding in things that a lot of people have been requesting.
So you've added that feature in 4?
Yeah, we've added that in, and that was probably the biggest thing with the registry, but we've also added a couple other things that just make it more on parity or closer to parity with Windows, with adding different kinds of registry keys you can add and things.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I mean, is clear about testing in general is that test engineers are really close to our customers, you know, has been my experience. And so what else have you learned from interacting with the real developers out there and then providing that feedback up to PMs and then finally developers who have to do it?
Well, I think one of the biggest things is just the features when we decide to add features in the next version, what we look at. And so just the feedback from the customer helps drive us a lot of looking at, well, what do they need and what mm-hmm. what do you do. So we might have something that's we think is kind of cool, but if nobody's going to use it, then it's kind of pointless to add it. So we look at what people are actually using and what things they need to be able to solve the problems they want and try and make those.
It's sort of interesting, too. So when we do features, a lot of times the PMs are the ones that kind of originally kind of drive what a feature is going to be. So we'll kind of come up with what we're going to do and then kind of go, you know, create the initial design of what it looks like. And then we work closely with the devs and the testers to kind of iterate on that design. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing from a test perspective is that the testers are almost like the first customers of that feature because they're the ones that are, you know, kind of the first ones using it. Mm-hmm. So we get a lot of good feedback just from working with the testers because they're the ones that have to use it. They're the ones that will find all these interesting issues. So it's kind of it's interesting our process. We work very closely in all the features we do with all the kind of three major roles, the PM, dev, and tests.
Triad.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, it's actually pretty interesting. We've also started recently including our user experience writers for this too, our user education, the people who do the MSDN documentation. And they're actually very in touch too because they'll see the comments that people will write on the MSDN documentation where they say this is confusing or this isn't actually how it behaves in the real world. And so they're the ones who do the samples and they're like, oh, this will be really confusing for, you know, a C# user or a VB user or something because they write the code samples and stuff like that. So it's been really helpful to involve them in the process too.
Excellent. So, you know, when new language innovations happen, I mean, all of you, including tests and PM, and everybody writes code pretty much on a product team, you're all writing in C#, aren't you?
Yes.
There's a fair bit of our tests that are still in VB, and that's been helpful to us at times. We like C# better, a lot, most of us, and we try to stick with it, but... Just only because that's what we're more comfortable with, though. Mm-hmm. And we have to recognize that a good number of our customers are using VB or other languages, mm-hmm. and there's been times where the tests being in VB have helped us find stuff like that, find issues with, oh, this doesn't work as well in VB, or this completely doesn't compile in VB, which is usually not our problem, but...
Well, I mean, that's interesting. That's one of the challenges.
It's been an interesting trade-off. Do we write in the right tests in the language that we're more comfortable writing with or spread them out in several languages so we can get more coverage that's not really our coverage, but it is sort of.
Absolutely. I mean, people are writing a lot of F# apps these days, and they're going to be calling all the same libraries you guys have written, right?
Yeah, we have to be careful when we're designing APIs because we really are the generalist kind of general APIs. They're really meant to be language independent, used from all languages. So we have to be very careful, and we're very mindful of that when we're designing APIs. So we have to, a lot of times what we'll do is when we're writing our specs or looking at different features we want to add, we'll say, like, well, what does it look like to use it from VB? What does it look like to use it now from F#? What does it look like to use from IPython? Mm-hmm. We have to keep that in mind just to kind of allow those different languages to work.
No, but I mean that's great. We should actually spend a little bit of time, take us through, you know, what is designing a new API look like from start to finish, right? I mean, you don't just pull it out of thin air. But I would ask that it's kind of interesting because functional languages, I mean, F# is a hybrid functional language, let's be honest, right? So it's not a pure functional language, not in the Eric Meyer sense of purity. So, but still, it's interesting that you guys have to support these languages that are radically different.
Right.
So how does that work anyway?
Well, so I guess I can speak to maybe a concrete example of this because I was involved in getting the common tuple type added to the base class libraries for 4.0. So tuple is a concept that doesn't exist so much in C# and VB. It's like a first class concept, but it is very popular in functional languages like F# or OCaml or Haskell. And what a tuple is it's basically, it's sort of like an array, except that every element can be of a different type. So with an array, you can say, if you wanted to store a string and an int in an array, you'd have to make an array of object, because that's the only common parent between them. With a tuple, you can say, I want a tuple of size 2. The first element is a string, and the second element is an int. And then that's really great because you get all the compiler time type safety information, and for F# you get type inference and all that great stuff. So that's a very very important part of the F-sharp language. It's in the language specification. You have to have these tuples. And with F-sharp coming on board, we looked at it and said, hey, this is really sort of a hole that we have in the framework. We'd like to bring it in for two reasons. One is it will be useful for C-sharp and VB developers. We sort of already have sort of masquerades of it today, like we have the key-value pair that is used as part of the dictionary implementation, and it's exposed to user code, which is really just a two-tuple. But what's also important is, you were saying about language interoperability, is F-sharp people are going to write libraries that expose either return types or arguments as tuples, because that's what is natural to them in their language. And if other dynamic languages or other functional languages come online and they wrote their own tuples, then you could end up in this weird scenario where you want to call across a language boundary and you have to do this marshalling. So, well, C-sharp, let's say they introduce a tuple type someday, but it wasn't the same tuple type as F-sharp. Now you have to sort of go do all this massaging to get the data in one format to another, which isn't good. So we decided tuple something we need to add to the base class libraries. And the way that we did that is basically set up meetings with the language architects from F-sharp. We got Anders in a room for a C-sharp perspective, brought people in from VB, people from the DLR, and basically said, what do you guys need us to support? You know, what is important for F-sharp? F-sharp had some, they already had a tuple type, so we could look at and say, you need these scenarios supported. But we said to VB and the DLR, like, what do you guys want as well? And then we sort of take all that feedback and then sort of do what our core competency is, which is sort of synthesizing that feedback and then producing an API that doesn't solve one set of problems, but sort of is a synthesis and fixes problems for everybody.
Sure.
And then get that re-reviewed by the language teams to make sure, are you still going to be able to be successful with this? And once they finally give us the go-ahead, we can get that.
Or they just go, the hell with you guys, we're adding it to the language. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's interesting. that's an interesting road that we have to walk, right? Because, I mean, you do run into situations where we don't want someone to say, well, I'm going to take my ball and go home, right? Because if they do that, then we'd have three or four tuple types floating around the system. No one would use the VCL tuple type, and it would just be this sort of component that we'd be carrying along for the rest of our lives that doesn't provide any
value. It's actually one of the challenges for our team. So as part of every team that produces a feature that goes in the framework has a certain process they have to follow. They have certain quality gates they have to meet before they can check a feature into the product. And one of those is doing kind of architecture reviews, API design reviews. And those reviews are really designed to help catch these issues. If during those reviews we see, like, you know, this team over here and this team over here are both adding a tuple type, we'll say, okay, like, we shouldn't be doing that. We should have a common type. And one of the challenges for our team often is that we see this duplication throughout the framework, and then it's challenging for us to prioritize, okay, in this release, we'll be able to take some of those and create a common type, but often we don't have time to kind of do everything, and so it's a challenge for us being able to fit that in, as well as being able to work on our own priorities as well, because we have stuff that we want to do around, like, managed code quality.
Sure.
That's some people can talk about here.
Yeah, there are a couple of interesting parts with that, too, because a lot of times when the language introduces a type and we see it's maybe starting to emerge in different places, they'll have, say, APIs that have certain language concepts built into the API itself. So a lot of the work we do is just making sure that the language-specific concepts are out of it, but then also one thing that was pretty interesting going through the F-sharp API reviews, you know, we have the framework design guidelines that the, you know, people who came from the VCL team originally wrote. And so if anything goes into the framework types, we want into the framework libraries, we want to make sure same patterns and naming conventions apply.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a great point because, I mean, you've been on this world forever.
You were canceled that right line.
This is it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So the original goal was you guys were that the languages don't matter, right?
Yes. I signed up to build a cross-platform and cross-language runtime. Yeah. And it took us about 10 years to get there, you know, in terms of all the cross-platform stuff. But, you know, we were pretty successful with the cross-language aspect of this early on in the game.
Absolutely.
You know, we had Project 7. We had so many researchers, you know, playing around with interesting languages, and they pointed out all sorts of ways the CLR needs to do a much better job, such as continuations and tail call and stuff like this. Some of it, that is still struggling a little bit. You know, tail call has all kinds of crazy heuristics in the JIT, but we have something in there that it's at least moving in the right direction and gives the languages something to, you know, experiment with. We really want to be successful with this, but at the same time, we also need to be a little bit realistic about this. We do have, I believe, Fujitsu is still supporting their COBOL implementation as well. So adding in new concepts like generics with covariant and contravariant type parameters to a language like COBOL is just a little bit on the strange side, yet still somewhat inevitable and needs to be supported. So we have this interesting role here of, in the libraries, we need to take some of the language innovations and in some places simply enable them, in other places use them in an intelligent way. And I was wondering if, you know, Kim had anything interesting to talk about.
Yeah, well, I'll talk about covariant support, covariance and contravariance. So I'll show an example of what that is before going to. But essentially, covariance and contravariance has been supported in the CLI, you know, for from the beginning, basically. Or is that true from the beginning?
From generics.
From generics.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah,
from the beginning of generics, yeah.
Yeah.
So, but it wasn't a mainstream scenario. Only recently did C-sharp and VB start exposing keywords that allow users to actually work with that. So I'll show you an example of what covariance and contravariance is. So so one other thing is I'm trying to change the working examples that people use in talking about covariance and contravariance. Everyone uses mammals and animals, and I always have a hard time with the mammal hierarchy, so I'm going to switch it to instruments. And we'll just say, or we'll say instrument, sorry, and then we'll say tuba. So tuba is an instrument. Right now, say you have method that takes an instrument. You know, obviously you can pass in a tuba and that works, but if you have something that takes an enumerable, I'll abbreviate it like that, of instrument, then you can't pass in an enumerable of tubas. And that's surprising to a lot of users, but it's basically because we don't support covariance right now. And it's a real pain for users right now. So this is an example of the languages did, you know, added support for the keyword. And in the libraries, then, we could annotate various interfaces and delegates that were capable of being annotated that way. There's very tight restrictions on them. We'll probably blog about it at some point. But yeah, basically, we enabled covariance on IEnumerable. And we enable covariance and contravariance and a few other types, like iComparer, iEquality Comparer, things like that. There's not that many that were eligible for it. So so basically, this is convenient because before, you'd have to element-wise cast them to do something like this. And now, with IEnumerable supported variants, you can use IEnumerables more broadly with that.
Excellent. And that, of course, bubbles way down into the all the code you guys write, the BCL, right? Which will end up doing what? What's the net? Better performance, better security, better reliability? What? Talk to me here.
In some
besides the compositional aspect of it.
Sure. It turns out that when we switch to generics, by introducing a much stronger type system statically in here, so you know exactly what is in a collection or what you'll get back from an enumerable, we avoided all sorts of bugs that people would run into. And we got a bunch of performance improvements as well. But the strong typing led you to problems where you can't do the assignment that you might otherwise expect.
Sure.
You can't, you know, pass a tuple of tuba to something that expected a tuple of instrument. And yes, that's unfortunate. This is what covariance and contravariance allows us to solve.
So we did have the very, very limited variant support first for arrays, but it's not of the safe kind. So for example, you can put in, you can attempt to put in an object and actually get a runtime exception. So by making the restrictions that they have, you won't run into those problems, but you can use certain types more broadly.
It also will help reduce some code duplication. Like here you might have had a play for iEnumerable of tuba and play for iEnumerable of trumpet and different things like that. And, you know, you fix a bug in one and you might not fix a bug in another one. So this way you can just write play of iEnumerable of instrument and you've only got your code written once and it'll handle all those cases.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about what else is going on. Let's go point it at the PM down at the end of the table.
So one of the other things we've done, we touched on this a little bit, but looking at what Windows has done in the past, what Windows has done in the future that isn't easy to use for managed code. So either you have to p-invoke yourself or kind of wait for someone to invent some wrapper. So we've gotten a lot of customer requests around things like that. One of the very long-standing requests that we've gotten was around memory map files. So being able to use memory map files easily from managed code. So in 4.0, we finally have nice wrappers around that, and it sort of complements our support we added in the last version for pipes. So both of these mechanisms can be used to do inter-process communication. Memory map files are also interesting in that they allow you to kind of edit extremely large files in an efficient manner. So that's one of the things that we also did in 4.0. And we're looking to do more of it in the future, but we have to find the right approach to doing that. One of the things we're looking at doing soon is launching a CodePlex site. And what we want to do there is actually get some of these things we're doing, both the wrappers as well as new things in our platform, and get those in the hands of customers early. There's a lot of benefits to doing that. Customers get to use, you know, try stuff out early. Mm-hmm. They can get involved with the actual design. So a lot of times, what happens is before we've done this is, you know, we'll go through the process of designing a feature and we'll ship it in the product. And then after we've shipped it, we've found out from customers or from ourselves that, you know, oops, we kind of shipped the wrong thing. We should have tweaked it in a certain way, and we didn't get that feedback in time to fix it. So then we sort of have to live with it forever. So the benefits of this CodePlex site that we're planning to launch is that, you know, we can iterate with the community and our customers, and we can catch those things, and we can tweak the design. And then eventually some of those things that we launch on CodePlex we'll pull back in the product, and then we'll have, like, a great, you know, mature API for everyone to use that's in the product and fully supported by Microsoft.
Outstanding.
So one other thing that's interesting about, or that I'm really excited about the CodePlex site that we're going to be launching is, based on where our team sits in the stack, we're sort of at the bottom. When we think about the release like Visual Studio 2010, we want to be locked down fairly early because components build on top of us, which means that we get a lot of really cool features into the product very early in the release cycle, but it still will be a long time before a CTP or a beta where the customers can actually see that. Mm-hmm. And the CodePlex side is going to sort of help us get things out faster. And the other problem is when we get something out in beta, the bar is starting to get higher and higher on customer feedback, where there might be a good change, but it sort of is a large-scale change that we'd have to go make, and we would say, oh, you know, it might be too late to do that. People have already built on top of this in our stack, and we can't go perturb the system as is. So getting stuff out earlier is going to be really great just from, a dev point of view, because you'll write the code and then people can see it, you know, within a week instead of waiting months for the beta to come out or whatever, and you'll get that feedback back from customers.
Awesome.
One exciting thing about that is there are a lot of features that we just, for whatever reason, we wrote them, not necessarily as features, just in our free time. Let's say we don't support zip compression. And, you know, enough people asked for it that over time, you know, several of us actually wrote our own zip compressor. But, you know, unless we sort of make the priority to get it out in a release, then we're just sort of sitting on it. So we'd really love to be releasing things that we know customers want and then start getting their feedback on the design of it, and they can start playing with these things faster and hopefully not switching to other solutions.
So Justin, maybe you can talk about how we keep saying what our customers want, but how do we know what the customers want?
Yeah, so every release we do, we sort of have certain things that will end up going in a release. So a big chunk of that is customer feedback, and we get customer feedback in a number of ways. I think the largest and most important way we get that is through connect bugs. So people can can give us both bugs and suggestions through Connect. And we actually look at those quite often, and we triage those every release we do to see which Connect bugs would, we can actually fit in a release. And unfortunately, some of our past most recent releases, it's been difficult for us to address some of this customer feedback due to the nature of our releases. So if you remember, for .NET 3.5, we were in this strange world where it was sort of .NET 2.0, but with new stuff. And we were limited to what we were limited as to what we could put into sort of the old stuff. So there, we would have a lot of customer requests of, you know, oh, you should improve string, or you should improve all the stuff that's cut sort of in MS CoreLib that we own. But given the nature of the release, we were very restricted as to what we were, could change in the 2.0 bits. We called it kind of red bits at the time. So now in 4.0, the great thing is we finally are able to address some of those things, and we're doing some of that. But going back to what we put in our release, so customer feedback is a big one, and Connect is the main place we get that feedback. But we also get it. We have a blog, blogs.msdn.com/bclteam, so we get a lot of feedback from the blog. We go to conferences like the PDC, and we talk to customers there. We go on customer visits and talk to customers. So it's a big aspect of what we do. Another kind of category of how we plan for a release is our partner feedback. We have lots of partners, as we discussed before, different languages, different teams at Microsoft. They're creating things. A lot, often they're creating general purpose things that really should be in the BCL, so we have to look at that. And then it is just sort of looking at the rest of the framework, the ecosystem, seeing if there is any duplication and trying to reduce that redundancy. Mm-hmm. And we basically do that for every release. We have kind of features that fall in those buckets, as well as each release sort of has different pillars for the release. So, like, for this release, one of the things that people are working on is better support for multi-core. So one of the things we've been working with is the Parallel Computing Platform team.
Yep.
They're adding a bunch of new stuff that we've actually partnered with them, and they're adding stuff to the BCL. So new Parallel APIs in the system threading namespace.
Well, they rewrote the thread pool, right?
Thread pools. Mm-hmm.
That was an interesting path.
Yeah. Another nice user, frequently requested user type things like lazy init and spin names. So those are, we're very eager to have those in the framework.
Awesome.
Yeah. And what about cloud computing? Yeah, that's the other big kind of thing. I mean, how does cloud computing impact programmability? You working on some cloud APIs, are you, Brian?
Not directly. We've got all sorts of very interesting things that we're doing for the next release.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them are immediately related to cloud computing, but I think that they're going to be enabling blocks that allow us to solve a huge number of scenarios.
Yeah, so that's actually a good question, because at the last, I was at the last PDC, and I talked to a few people in the cloud group, and I was very eager to find out what kinds of things the base class libraries can do for them. And it turned out that what they wanted was what a lot of other people want. They want, you know, better performance improvements, and I think trace listening was one of the other commonly requested things. So it's convenient that a lot of what they were asking for was something that a lot of other customers are asking for. So.
I own the diagnostic stuff, and so tracing sort of falls into there. And so I've had conversation with the, I'm going to butcher their name. Is it Azure? How is
Azure.
It?
Azure.
Yeah.
Azure. Like jazz. Okay.
Yeah.
But Azure at the end.
That team about, you know, we have some tracing components in the BCL, and they want to build on top of those to give a richer tracing infrastructure for cloud computing. So another nice thing about the team is that we are able to sort of provide our expertise to partners Upstack. So there are actually teams that aren't on the BCL that will be introducing managed APIs that will actually have us set up a meeting with them to just look over their spec and provide our sort of guidance on what the right thing to do is. And that's right. An interesting exposure you get on this team. You really do see a lot of anybody who's sort of building a managed component at Microsoft, you may end up talking to because they want your expertise in some area.
And in fact, we already have some very interesting directions to grow in the future version as well, in .NET 5 or 6 or whatever we end up calling it. We will end up taking a very hard look at concurrency and seeing if there's any ways that we can help make this a very simple problem for people. The parallel computing team has been doing some very interesting prototype work there, and there may be extraordinarily deep changes to the type system that come out of that. So that's one area we want to look. But additionally, our friends in Microsoft Research are an amazing asset here for us. There are a number of research projects out there for helping improve unit testing today, but also to look at race conditions in code. It's amazing. They've got this tool called Chess that will allow you to run essentially two different methods on different threads with every possible interleaving between those two threads. So if you look at the number of instructions and say it's, you know, roughly n in here, the problem is you have to run each one of those n instructions with context switches with each of these m other instructions. It's a very hard thing to actually do in any stress tests. But if you have a very deterministic way to get to all of your simple bugs that you can find with one or two context switches here and there, then you know you never need to write thread.sleep in the middle of your code to try to hit some race condition. It's great. So we've been looking at helping our researchers as well to try to bridge the gap into the development side and to try to productize some of that stuff, or at the very least make sure it certainly applies to all of our scenarios. There's a bunch of stuff we need to add to the framework for that as well. But,
One thing Matt mentioned was that a lot of people will seek our expertise as the BCL, but we also tend to work with a lot of other area experts. Like for some of our resources and globalization work in the framework, we partner closely with the Windows team, who provides a lot of that data and does a lot of that work on the Windows side, so we can try to get a consistent story and leverage their expertise on that too. Mm-hmm. So it's we work both ways. We're specialists for some people, but we're also generalists who pull in a lot of specialized data from other people on the throughout all of Microsoft.
Excellent. Well, hey, you know, 4 years or four iterations. Impressive. Congratulations.
And that's awesome.
It's definitely maturing. One thing I would ask, though, is in your assessment, baking static types into the CLR, was that a good idea?
You mean the notion of static classes in C#?
Yeah.
Oh, that was incredibly great.
Hey, great to talk to you guys. And it's very nice. I mean, we do a Women in Technology series on Channel 9. I must say it's nice to see somewhat gender balance starting to happen in the engineering world. I'm impressed. This is not the case typically around the company. Yeah. Anyway, great to meet you. And thank you. You will have more to speak.
One brief piece.
Yes.
So. Tell my interviews never end when they're going to end. So it's perfect.
Yes. So one of the things that we've been really excited about in this release is managed contracts or code contracts. So.
Well, that's right. This interview was about what's new in .4.
Yeah.
Thanks for reminding
exactly.
me.
So many of our other features are incredibly great, but they're very deep in going after very specific scenarios. Mm-hmm. NoPIA was, you know, an incredibly great feature for the customers that care about comm interop. Everyone else may not exactly even know what a PIA is to begin with. But managed contracts or code contracts allows us to express preconditions and postconditions and object invariants in our managed code. And this is a great idea that impacts pretty much everyone developing a managed code. The idea is that we've invented some additional methods that you can explicitly call. We have some tools to sort of rearrange all the code in the right ways and handle inheritance and interfaces and all sort of complicated stuff. But then you can get both runtime checking for your errors, and we have a static analysis tool as well that will look for bugs in your code. You can even find bugs in your code without writing a test case. Now, I wouldn't exactly advise that, and I imagine the testers in the room are, you know, appalled that I'm suggesting this. But for developers,
it's great. You should find bugs in your code before you write test cases, and then you should write your test cases.
Yes, yes, brilliant, Katie. But it is great that we have some static analysis tools that will at least reduce the cost of finding some of these bugs for developers.
Cool. Now, that's obviously based on, again, research and Spec Sharp,
yeah.
Wolfram and his gang.
Yes.
One of the really neat things about that is SpecSharp was a research project that was a language that did this. So they had a specific language that you could use to get all these preconditions, postconditions, etc.
Mm-hmm.
One of the neat things about the doing this as part of the base class libraries is that now you can use it from any language.
Awesome.
So instead of having to, you know, write all your code in SpecSharp, you can write all your code in VB or C Sharp or F Sharp, and it's just the compilers see it as method calls.
Awesome.
So that's a really great benefit of doing it language agnostically, which is an advantage you pretty much only get in the libraries.
Excellent. Well, I mean, that's one of the advantages of .NET,
yeah.
Right? Or Java or anything. Well, Java's just only one syntax, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, additionally, we've actually made this available on DevLabs.
Perfect.
Which was great, because we got customers playing around with this before we even shipped beta 1 of the product. And surprisingly, we got some really good feedback from our customers on this.
I don't think that's necessarily surprising.
Well, all right. Sorry.
That's kind of why we put it up there to begin with.
We got great feedback, and we realized that we need to go rethink some things about this. So we had some failure behavior that we thought made a lot of sense for certain cases. We are working on trying to tweak that a little bit. To, you know, more appropriately meet our customers' needs.
So in other words, I mean, because when we did, when SpecSharp was first announced, or, you know, people could finally play around with it from research, everyone was like, bake it into C#, man, this is amazing. So it's even better that you're doing it this way, because it doesn't matter what language you're using, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Very cool.
And that's 4.0, shipping in the base class library contracts.
Yes.
Amazing. I really didn't think you guys were going to do that. Impressive.
We're pulling it off.
Yeah, we're nice. Already adding contracts to a lot of the base class libraries types. So, you know, we have fairly broad support at certain levels, the ones that have been, you can talk more about the ones that have been generated, but we've been using it more broadly. I'm one of the few people with the Eiffel programming background, so I really love design by contract, and it's been nice having those in the framework, because it serves as a good way to help harden basically classes where, you know, maybe the contracts are captured in either comments or just sort of I don't know the right word. I don't want to say like make it sound like hack, but you know, mm-hmm. like sort of. Mm-hmm. You know, temporary
documentation fixes. That people may not read.
Yes, yes, mm-hmm. We'll say that. Okay, mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll dodge that one. So, right, so, you know, say for a class, like, you know, anything that maintains state, like a length and capacity and various members that maybe have somewhat complex relationships with each other, you can use contracts to help enforce them. And so it's a really good way of, you know, documenting it in a way that is actually captured and enforced.
Well, I mean, it also speaks to the notion of, like, composability, which goes to the heart of what we're trying to do with the CLR in the first place, so people mm-hmm. can develop composable systems. Contracts give you a better sense of something, you know, that you can rely on something happening or not happening.
Yes, absolutely. And they are an enabling technology as well. There's another tool in research called PEX that's a test tool for...
Yep.
The great thing about PEX is you can write a very simple unit test where it tests a certain amount of code, or it tests a particular method, but it can pick the inputs to that method. So if you have all sorts of bizarre corner cases inside the actual implementation of the method based on the exact set of inputs that are passed in, PEX will allow you to get 100% code coverage.
Sometimes.
Or it certainly tries that direction, and it's getting better.
Yeah.
So that's great, but 100% code coverage is useless unless you know that what you've gotten out is correct. And this is where contracts come in and really provide that correctness heuristic then to PEX to allow it to get even further. You can actually play around with both Chess and PEX on DevLabs. So yeah. Download those.
And we have stuff on Channel 9 covering that as well. And the Wolfram and his gang, I guess they're called Rise.
Yeah.
They're busting out all kinds of cool things.
Mm-hmm. Research and software
and the fact that you're starting to actually stick it into a generic library or, you know, a general purpose library is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. So what else? What else have we missed?
Can we plug Connect just once more? Because, I know, before... I'll be honest, before I started... I've been working here for, 2.5 years now. Before I started working here, I didn't know about Connect. And I think there might be an impression from some people that, Connect is a memory hole where you just, vent at Microsoft and then no one ever reads it. But the bugs and the votes that people do on Connect, they do end up... if you find a bug in a component that I own and you report it through Connect, I'm going to read your bug report. I'm going to go investigate the issue and fix the bug and respond back to you. So it's one of the best ways to let us know the pain points that you guys are feeling and to get those things addressed. So don't just, when you run into a problem, be like, oh, stupid Microsoft, I can't believe, how did they miss this? Let us know about it, because we do want to get that feedback, and we're not perfect, but we do want to become better.
People even write feature requests there as well, so we find good bugs that way, but then they'll also write about features that they want, so we like seeing that feedback as well. On our blog, any place that you can find to contact us.
Another much more subtle way to give us feedback is with Watson crashed ups.
Yes.
So if your application just simply crashes and you get the little box saying, oh, an error occurred, you want to send this error to Microsoft? You send it to us, someone here in Redmond is going to take a look at that eventually.
That's always great when you're angry, too. If you're really angry that your app crashed, you definitely should send the error report, because it does generate work. Mm-hmm. For someone. you really are just, when you click that button, you're really sticking it to someone here on campus. They've got to go look at that.
About what you said, that was something where before I came here, I think, I don't know, I mean, I guess maybe this is okay to say, feel free to cut it off.
No, we don't edit. It's channel 9, feel free.
I just assumed, the worst possible case, not only was it not going to send the information, it was probably scavenging for credit card data, social security numbers, and it's not doing that. It really just gives a bug information, which we then can address. A lot of times they're really good stress types of bugs. Mm-hmm.
So in particular, we had a very common crash in, I think, the Everett version of our product, and it was because I did some really cool optimizations to array.reverse, of all things. Maybe not the most interesting API, but if you passed in a zero-length array to array.reverse, it would blow up because I forgot to check some bounds. And so we got Watson reports about that, and a good number of them. And it's like, oh, it's pretty clear what the problem is here. We had a small, small test hole, but clearly we fixed that. And it made the world a better place for all of us.
Excellent, man. Well, I mean, I think .NET's on its way to making the world a better place for... for developers. I mean, it's an impressive suite of functionality in its fourth iteration. It's just hard to believe time's going by that fast. But thank you so much for the time today. And we'll come back and visit you. And I think we'll look at code sometime. And you feel free to, in all of your time, you have a lot of spare time. to write screen, to do some screencasts, and throw them up and show people your code, how to do things.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.